Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here with our first case, 10-1406, the State of Ohio versus Mark Pickens. For the appellant, Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. As introduced, my name is Dan Burke. I also have co-counsel Roger Kirk. We're both representing Mr. Pickens. At this time, Judge, we're asking for a split argument. I'm going to handle one issue and Mr. Kirk is going to handle the other issue. So we're asking for, Your Honor, a split of 15 to 12 and then for Mr. Kirk in 3 minutes rebuttal time. Judge, the proposition of law that we have put forth in our original brief was 10 propositions, 1 through 10. Today we're going to argue basically, Mr. Kirk is going to argue misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, ineffective assistance of counsel, and I'm going to argue the forfeiture by wrongdoing issue that I believe is very important in this case. As we start that argument, I'm requesting that the court consider I had a Scribner's error in our argument or our brief, which on Ohio Revised Code 29.2904A3, the penalty, the spec was actually in our brief as A8. Mr. Cummings in his brief corrected that, and I'm just asking the court to consider that as a Scribner's error and proceed for that. Your Honors, the case before you, Mr. Pickens, basically is a case of forfeiture by wrongdoing, which is an issue that doesn't apply or doesn't appear very often in our court system. One of the biggest cases that I have or that we're going to argue today is Giles v. California, which is a Supreme Court case of Justice Scalia. Gave the argument, and the biggest thing he raised in that issue, which I'm raising today, is the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause. And during that Confrontation Clause, Judge Scalia said that it is very important in our positions and our court system that we have the right to have a Confrontation Clause. The forfeiture by wrongdoing, which was allowed in this particular case, we believe does not grant that Confrontation Clause. We believe that the forfeiture by wrongdoing in this case is improper and it should not be, as Judge Scalia said in Giles, that it should not be go forward with it. That Mr. Pickens has the right to confrontation. He has the right to have witnesses. He does not have the right to have the voluminous hearsay evidence that was accepted by the judge in this case.
And you're talking about the testimony of the same nurse for the medical examination upon the accusation of rape.
That's correct. I'm talking about the accusation of the rape case, Your Honor. Thank you.
Right, and you're talking specifically about the testimony that was allowed by the nurse, sane nurse that examined the decedent.
Your Honor, I was talking about all the testimony. Not only did we have the sane nurse's testimony, but we had 11 other witnesses that were were spoken in front, and all of them accused or made comments about that Ms. Washington talked about a rape case and that she was raped.
You're talking about the neighbor, for example, that allowed her to use the telephone after, you know, that she was pounding on her door. That was let in just based on excited utterances, correct?
That's correct.
You don't think that was an excited utterance?
Yes, but again, that's a statement made by Ms. Washington. And the issue that we have is that there were other witnesses, her cousin, her sister, her mother. Each of the people that testified in this particular case were all hearsay evidence by her, and they're all conflicting. If you read all that, the information that took place on that day, or I mean, on that argument, all of them conflicted. There was testimony that she ran naked out of the house, out of the apartment. Well, there was videos that show she wasn't naked when she ran out. There are statements that she said told the police that he beat her, and he raped her and beat her. That didn't happen either, based on the conflicts of what she then told, or what the officer said, Officer Jenkins and Dr. Schroeder, who actually saw the issue, saw her, took her down to the station, and interviewed her, basically. And during that time period, that they saw no bruising, and they testified to that. So the conflict is there. There is a conflict, and where do we stop the hearsay? She changes her story on numerous occasions in front of Tamika Washington. She changed where she said she was beaten. Denisha Scott, where she said that there was a gun pointed at her head as she was being raped, which is not the story that she originally told the police officers. She told the police officers that she went over that day to have sex, and they got a little rough, and then he took a gun out and put it on the bed. But in this particular case,
counsel, the issue is whether or not hearsay can come in, right? Not whether you've got hearsay, and they're inconsistent stories. That there's no test for that, is there?
Well, that's what we're arguing about. No, there's no test for that. The issue, though, Your Honor, is that the Justice Scalia, because the judge himself, in this particular case himself, made a decision in this case that the forfeiture by wrongdoing, the motion filed by the state of Ohio, was proper based on what he heard. And Justice Scalia said in a headnote, the notion that a judge may strip the defendant of a right that the United States Constitution deems essential to a fair trial on the basis of a prior judicial assessment that the defendant is guilty as charged does not sit well with the right to a trial by jury. Is akin, one might say, dispensing with a jury trial because the defendant is
and you think that's what happened here, is the judge made his rulings because he knew the defendant had committed the acts
I believe that he
was on trial for.
I'm sorry, Judge. Your Honor, I believe, Justice, yes, that he did. He made that statement, or of all the evidence, the conflicting evidence that was done, or that came forward, and he made his decision based on that. He is a judge. Now, granted, it's preponderance, and we know that, but that's why I think the forfeiture, wrongdoing by forfeiture in this case is improper, because he made that decision based on the hearsay, and then goes forward, and then the jury then has to make a decision beyond a reasonable doubt, but they now get in all that hearsay evidence from the judge's decision on preponderance. I think that's improper. And just so the court, again, quote the judge in that particular case, so there are certainly, this is his statement, there are certainly questions raised as to whether the police officers at the time really believed her. They questioned her statement, they tested her, but that is not as much as an issue as the fact that they have proven beyond any doubt, certainly by preponderance at this point in time. You'll be able to get into the evidence at trial. Well, that's the issue we're having here, that the judge even put out there that he questioned what the witnesses said, what Ms. Washington said to all the witnesses, and the hearsay, and there was an issue whether the police even believed it. In fact,
well, counsel, is that the test? Getting back to Justice Pfeiffer's statement here, the consistency is not the issue in deciding the admissibility of evidence.
Consistency
of the statements is not the test that we look at when we're deciding, for example, an excited utterance or examination statements made during the examination to a nurse treating someone for rape, the investigatory process there. Is consistency, in other words, the statements and the contents have to match up before the court is going to allow them to be brought in?
Your Honor, I believe that consistency is important here because of the nature of
it's
the charge.
It's important to the jury when they're trying to weigh the credibility of the statements, but not for their admissibility, is it?
Oh, I believe it is, because we're giving the jury all this hearsay evidence, I do not believe, based on all the evidence that was in this case, most of it, I believe, came from the hearsay, the continuing issues about I was raped, she got raped, all that, plus the nature of the charges and the shootings, pushes a jury towards that decision. I believe the forfeiture by wrongdoing is improper in this case, because I don't believe, again, that Mr. Pickens gets a fair trial by having all that evidence, all that hearsay evidence put into the record and again repeated in front of a jury that's hearsay.
Well, now it pushes the jury, you said, in the direction of a certain decision. Are you now talking about the death sentence?
Yes.
To the guilty
and then to the death sentence.
Well, which?
To the guilt.
You think it pushes them?
Yes.
Without the hearsay, there's a chance they're going to find him not guilty of the murder.
I do. Based on the facts of this case, I believe that.
So you're saying even if we took away all the evidence that you're talking about, if we were to exclude it, you're saying there's insufficient evidence that your client committed the killing of Ms. Washington and the two children?
I believe there's not enough evidence that if you eliminate the forfeiture by wrongdoing and all that evidence that came out in that particular motion or that argument, yes, I believe that.
But that was all related to the rape.
All to the rape, not
but,
to the killing.
But we're talking about the real, we have also an indictment that talks about murder of children under 13. And you've got two children, as well as Ms. Washington, that were killed. And you're saying that even if we exclude all that other evidence, that there's insufficient evidence to find him guilty of aggravated murder.
I do, Judge, Justice. Because of the spec that they used, the state of Ohio used the spec. They didn't use the homicide spec of the killing of two people. They used the spec of 29, what I mentioned before, 2945, the A3 section.
Only one they used?
That was what they used in this case, yes, Your Honor. Honor, yes. That was the death spec that was on this case. Justice Scalia, again, in his statement, that the he mentions the confrontation clause again. And in Giles, Justice Scalia actually went from the beginning of time, what I say the beginning of time, from 1666, and followed the law from 1666 until the present, going through all the cases, all the possible cases regarding the confrontation clause and whether a person has the right to confront the witnesses in the situation, and he raised it all the way through.
Counsel, I'm having trouble following your argument this morning. Maybe you can help me.
Sure.
Are you saying that but for the excluded evidence, there is not sufficient evidence to find him guilty of capital murder, but there is sufficient for regular murder?
I do not. I'm saying, Your Honor, that excluding that evidence, I do not believe there's enough. I mean, excluding that evidence from the forfeiture by wrongdoing hearing, I believe that there is not enough evidence to go even for the murder case. I mean, for the capital murder case. I do not believe it. I believe that the rape case that was part of this argument the police officers didn't even believe her at the beginning. The officers at this particular case did not, after she was accused, Mr. Pickens, of rape, did not go to the place and arrest him or go charge him. What they did, they went to his apartment and stuck a card in the door. Now, that to me, to that situation, is not somebody that they thought at that time was an issue with the rape case. And again, that's what the judge said in his statement Judge Martin did in his statement. I believe that there was not enough, and actually they didn't even indict him for the rape case until they were indicted for the death penalty case. He was not indicted. He was not. There was a charge made, but there was no complaint filed. The issue of the until after the death penalty case was filed at 3 months after in August of 2009. So the issue then is that the forfeiture, we believe, if not given the chance and hearing that all that evidence from the forfeiture that the issue of the final decision by the jury would not be there. Justice Souter talked about it, and he was in favor of it, and so the situation, and he makes statements that equity demands something more than near circularity before the right to confrontation is forfeited, and more supplied by showing intent to prevent the witnesses from testifying. This is Justice Souter, and also there's a 6-3 decision in the Giles case in favor of the confrontation clause and the right to have a confrontation clause. We believe that the confrontation clause of the Sixth Amendment was not done. The OC case, again, that this court ruled on talked about the quality of the quantity of evidence to support a spec. Well, we believe that in this particular case, there would not be that quality of quantity of evidence if a forfeiture of wrongdoing was not granted by the judge, and allowing the jury to hear all that information, we believe is improper. Thank you. I'll turn it over to my co-counsel. Thank you. If you have no other questions.
Mr. Kirk.
May it please the court. I need to apologize right off at the beginning. I've had a real bad head cold, so I'm kind of hoarse, but I'm going to do the best I can to hopefully enunciate as well as I can. I'd like to focus my presentation on the area of prosecutorial misconduct. It's proposition of law number 3 in our brief. Our position is that Mr. Pickens did not receive a fair trial due to improper comments by the prosecutor. And I know the court knows that their test that's been, I believe, since the 1980s, is State versus Smith, where the test is laid out that whether the prosecutor makes improper comments and whether they prejudicially affect the substantial rights of the defendant, then the next question is, well, what's affecting the substantial rights of a defendant? And in this situation, it's been held that the prejudice is when the remarks are so inflammatory as to render the jury's decision a product solely of passion and prejudice. The danger and the problem that violates the due process, as the court's well aware, is that when a prosecutor starts to go over the line and strays out into areas that aren't within the boundaries of law, that the jury is not focused on evidence. Instead, it's looking at things that are outside evidence. If a prosecutor is misstating evidence or is speculating, denigrates counsel, there's a lot of areas. And what I was going to try to do is touch, because I know I have limited time, on different areas that I think applies to this situation. In the opening statement, I'm going to read the quote quickly. Prosecutor stated, there's only going to be one fair, just, and proper verdict you can return that would comport with the oaths you have taken as jurors, and that is that this man right here is guilty of raping Noel Washington, and that he's guilty of aggravated murder. The problem that I see with that is that, in essence, it's a call to duty. The only way you can honor your oath is to convict this man. If you don't do it, I believe the message is subtle but implied, that he would then be acquitted, he would be on the streets, he's a murderer. that would be running around. And it could be hurting you, your family. I think that's an improper.
You read all of that into the statement of you've got to follow your oath?
I think when they start to talk about it's your duty, when they use the term duty to follow an oath, that there's almost a compulsion that you can only find one area. And I know prosecutors have latitude to make argue what they feel the evidence is, but I think this goes over the line and that it just went too far. And in this situation here, there wasn't a defense objection. But I wanted to reference back, and I know the court's well aware of this, recently you issued the decision in State versus Kirkland, which is also out of Hamilton County. And on page 17 of the majority opinion, it is stated that even if there isn't an objection, it's important to look at all the comments in their entirety and to preserve that for review in the record.
Do you have any case authority? Mr. Kirk, do you have any case authority to the effect that the prosecutor's suggestion that the jurors have a duty to follow their oath is an improper statement?
I'm relying basically on the fundamental tenets of State versus Smith, just the original prosecutorial misconduct.
We didn't say that in Smith.
Well, just the fact that a prosecutor, just the general test that they're not allowed to make improper conducts that could prejudice a defendant. I didn't cite a specific case.
I'm understanding that you have no case from any other state Supreme Court or federal jurisdiction that says if a prosecutor suggests that the jurors have a duty to follow their oath, it's improper argument.
I don't have a specific case, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Kirk, were you and Mr. Burke the trial counsel in this case?
We were not, Your Honor.
All right. Were there any objections? Were all these, it seems like you're talking about cumulative error. That's your argument, that the prosecutor, that these statements all were cumulative error. Were there objections made to every single point?
And I was going to hit a few other points. There are some objections on some of the comments. Some of them were sustained by the court. Others, there weren't objections.
Thank you.
I could kind of do it piece at a time, and I'll just hit it quickly. Okay. So in other words, it's all over the map, and it's a little bit of everything. And I know the standard's a little different when it falls into that. The other instance, Your Honors, is in the closing argument of the trial phase, the prosecutor labeled Mr. Pickens a killer. His quote is, "So one killer to another, Pickens to Lee." Lee was a jailhouse snitch named Montez Lee that was introduced into the trial basically late in the game. I think this went over the line. This was objected to, and it was overruled by the trial court. I believe that was error. I think it did affect Mr. Pickens' due process rights because basically denigrating him, labeling him as a killer, which in evokes passion and hatred, I think, from a jury. I think it went outside the bounds. I think it's applicable almost to calling somebody a monster. You're not allowed to do that. I think it just goes too far and inflames the passion instead of looking at the evidence and commenting on evidence.
But there was evidence that Mr. Pickens did shoot three people and kill them. That was already in the testimony, correct?
The testimony was in, Your Honor, but their decision hadn't been made yet, and I feel like in the closing argument it was still ratcheting things up to making almost a conclusory comment that this was the final result.
The state is never equivocal on whether or not they're prosecuting a murderer in the closing argument. They don't, was mentioned by your co-counsel, there's leeway that is given to the prosecutor, both in opening and closing.
There is, Your Honor. I think it's almost a subtle distinction. I think by labeling somebody a killer, you can argue about the evidence. Did somebody kill somebody? You know, was it murder, aggravated murder? I think just the emotion and the arousing of calling somebody a killer invokes passion and hatred. I think that could have been phrased differently, and I think
that's what could they have used the word murderer?
Murder would be a little different. It's in that same vein, Your Honor, but I think killer is just too primal, too inflammatory. And
what, in your view, would be acceptable?
Well, I think you just have to, if they're arguing that somebody killed somebody, They would just have to phrase it like that rather than just a label of one sent, a word type of.
Well, they were talking about two different people who had something in common, and that was the termination of another human being's life. In your case, your client, three members or three people. Would you have preferred, you know, one felon to another, one criminal to another, that sort of thing?
Well, I think actually would have been going down the right road a little better. I think just the term killer, it just invokes passion and that kind of thing, Your Honor. The other instance, just so I can move in, I don't know how much time I have left, but the other comment the prosecutor made, the evidence is overwhelming. I would ask you to find, this is in the trial phase, I would ask you to find him guilty. We will come back in a couple of days and figure out the appropriate penalty in the penalty phase of this trial. I think that's error. Same kind of situation where there, it's part of that comment is typical, but I think to say that we will come back in a couple of days, it's almost demanding the jury that there's only one result and that now we're going to focus, presupposing that he's guilty at that point, and that we're going to only focus on does he get the death penalty or some other penalty less severe. I just think that went over the line there as far as that goes. That one was objected to and sustained, but I think the error was still there. There's that phrase that you can't unring a bell. I think the more comments a prosecutor makes, the more of a pattern it becomes, whether they're sustained or objected to or not. The jury is still going to hear that, and I think it is going to have a negative impact on a defendant's right to have due process. Also in the, and I'm going to move to the closing argument in the penalty phase, the prosecutor led off his closing with a comment to defense counsel. I don't know how he can, with a straight face, argue that he shouldn't get life when he argued that he hadn't committed the murders, that he was not guilty. I read that as basically denigrating a defense counsel, the defendant. It's hard enough in a death penalty case when you have two phases. Usually a lot of times the attorneys have different roles, but for the prosecutor to highlight that right off the bat, saying, you know, this man, the attorney for the defendant, cannot in good conscience or with any credibility tell you don't give him the death penalty because, you know, earlier he said he was not guilty. I think that went over the line, and there was in that invoked, and basically it invoked extra hatred again for Pickens, I think, in that whole vein. That's how he led off his closing argument. He also went through, and this is what I think is similar to State versus Kirkland, and I know that was a 4-3 decision that was for affirmation and didn't reverse. However, I know there were a lot of concurrences and dissents, even in the majority, that I believe harshly criticized the prosecutor's office for their prosecutorial misconduct in their closing arguments. And a lot of the things, if you read closely in Pickens, it's the same prosecutor actually that tried the Kirkland case, and he made comments about what the children must have felt when they were dying. The exact quote was, did Shay, that's one of the children, know what was coming or not, moments filled with the terror of what was coming. At least he died in his mother's arms because Shay died alone. Well, there wasn't testimony as to that. Nobody knows what exactly that situation was. Speculation, I believe it inflamed the hatred, the passion for Mr. Pickens unfairly. And it went on again on the other pages in the transcript. There's about 25 pages in that same area that goes to that same kind of situation. And to me, it struck me as being very, very close, almost identical to the Kirkland case. And I'd ask you to look at that. It's kind of hard to pinpoint every single one of them, but that whole area is speculation, is playing to the passion of a jury, and not
also,
on
evidence.
You're
into your rebuttal time if that matters.
Your Honor, I'll go ahead and sum it up. Basically, just the argument, and I think what's important is that, in view of Mr. Burke's argument as well, the position is that with the forfeiture by wrongdoing, there was if that had not come in and been properly ruled upon, that this case would be a close case and actually would be not meet the burden for a guilty verdict. And with that all going on, plus all the prosecutorial misconduct, I think that pushes it over the edge, and I would ask the court to consider that their decision to reverse and remand for a new trial. That's all he's asking for is due process in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, justices. My name is Phil Cummings. I represent the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office in the state of Ohio.
Mr. Cummings,
morning.
Before you get too far
yes.
into your argument, you're not into it at all. Can you tell me what were the counts that were contained in the indictment against the defendant here? Your opposing counsel said that there was only one death spec, and that was that hinged on the finding of rape, and that was the only avenue to the death spec.
Well, Your Honor, there were two death specs per victim. The death spec for Noel Washington contained the rape spec and also the course of conduct spec.
Was that under A8 or A7? The A7 felony murder or the A8 about being a witness or having him killing a witness to who was going to testify against him?
Felony murder, I believe.
Felony murder.
Yes. The two children each had two death specs as well. Shay Wright had course of conduct and the killing of a child under 13, and the same with Anthony, course of conduct and killing of him, a child under 13. So there were two death specs per victim here.
Counsel, that troubled me when I read the trial court's entry. It said he killed the children for a reason. What's the reason?
Well, he killed the Shay Wright because he was afraid she could identify him. And he claimed to his jailhouse cellmate that he killed the baby because he got a rush out of it.
Because he got a what?
A rush, R-U-S-H. That's what
not,
he claims
but
he
that's
did.
Not an aggravated murder spec, is it?
No, but all of this testimony came in pursuant to the forfeiture by wrongdoing concept that he killed Noelle to prohibit her from reporting his rape of her. And that's the whole paradigm under which all this hearsay was accepted, and it came in under a forfeiture by wrongdoing theory. I'd just like to point out that this is a record case. This is an appeal as of right. By that, I mean there's no new or novel issue here that needs to be decided, and no new law needs to be made to decide this. This was a very well-tried case by both sides below. The trial court prohibited the defense from calling no witnesses it wanted to. It actually provided funding for experts, which the defense chose not to utilize, and they actually put that on the record on page 3286. This is a striking case in the sense that the various standards of proof, like in the forfeiture by wrongdoing, is preponderance of the evidence, and of course in a trial it's reasonable doubt. The evidence in this case prompted the trial judge to separately state on two occasions that the state proved its case here beyond all doubt, and in his opinion he actually said there's no residual doubt at all in this case. And I think that's striking, and I think when this court reviews the record, it will see that the record does support that.
Counsel,
that
both
conclusion.
Of you are talking about forfeiture by wrongdoing. Can you elaborate a little bit on what the motion was before the trial court and then the prosecutor's response?
Well, the motion, the state proceeded on this forfeiture by wrongdoing.
So it was
hearing.
The state that made the motion?
They wanted to have a hearing to determine whether or not they could enter this evidence into trial. And this was conducted pursuant to Ohio Rule of Evidence 804B6. And that statute, or that rule, reads, a statement offered against Pickens, in this case, due to the unavailability of the witness, which would be Miss Washington, is admissible if it is due to the wrongdoing of Pickens for the purpose of preventing the witness from attending or testifying. This whole hearing was conducted based upon the premise that the state's contention was Pickens killed Noelle to keep her from reporting and following through with the rape charges that he knew she was pursuing. I might add, if you look at the Giles case, which the defense has cited, Justice Scalia actually cites with approval Ohio's evidence rule on footnote 2 of his opinion in Giles. He's citing Ohio's rule of evidence here, our forfeiture by wrongdoing section. He's citing that with approval, saying that the language of Ohio's rule does contemplate that we show purpose. It has to be for the purpose of preventing Ms. Washington from pursuing the rape. That's pretty much all the evidence that was presented at this hearing. Witness after witness after witness testified. Not only did Noelle Washington tell them that she was raped, but she told them she was going to pursue a rape charge against him. All the hearing's evidence went to the purpose and the rape charge, and that's why there was no doubt that this was admissible under the rule. And this is a rule that is endorsed by Justice Scalia in the Giles decision.
So was the argument that it was not, the evidence was not being offered to prove that she was in fact raped? The evidence was offered to prove that she was going to report this information?
Both.
I guess, you know, the truth of the matter asserted is what I think you're suggesting, that it was not offered for the truth of a rape being actually, you know, done, but the fact that she was going to start the machinery against
Correct.
Him.
Correct. That's true. But and we met that burden at the forfeiture hearing. I do want to point out, though, that once you get to the trial of the issue, then it is incumbent upon the state to prove that Noelle was raped, because that is a prerequisite to finding the guilt and the aggravated murder spec that she was raped. So the same testimony was used for both purposes ultimately. Yeah, but for the initial purpose of the forfeiture hearing, it was to go to his purpose was to prevent her from testifying or pursuing the rape charge. And that burden was overwhelmingly met. I would just note parenthetically that even if you set aside the forfeiture by wrongdoing exception, I think most of this other hearsay would come in under other exceptions, as you mentioned, statements for medical diagnosis and treatment, statements against interest. I know Pickens said some things that would have come in because it was against his interests. Also, excited utterance, present sense impression. These statements were probably going to come in bulk one way or the other, but the forfeiture by wrongdoing was just the easiest and most obvious way to do it here, and that's what we did.
Could you answer the same question that I asked earlier, which is, if all of this evidence were excluded that is being, you know, argued about now, if it was all taken away, would there be sufficient evidence of the aggravated murder with respect to the children? Or does the whole thing fall if we find against you on this point?
Not at all. Absolutely. There's more than enough sufficient evidence, even if you take away all this hearsay. For instance, he confessed to his jailhouse roommate that he did it, and he actually explained how he did it. The jailhouse cellmate knew details that were not released to the public. He could have only gotten these details from an accurate confession by Pickens. He was seen arriving at the scene of the apartment and leaving by witnesses that identified him. He had gunshot residue on his hands, on his jacket, on the bike that he's seen riding. So even if you just took away the statements, you'd have an overwhelming circumstantial case. Luckily, we didn't need to rely upon the circumstances alone, because we had all of this admissible forfeiture by wrongdoing statements. As far as the prosecutorial misconduct goes, I think this court will, when it reviews the record, it will find that probably two-thirds of these objected to statements were not objected to. So the defendant waived them. In light of the overwhelming evidence, there's no plain error here. This case doesn't come near to approaching some of the issues that troubled this court in Kirkland. There was no discussion of facts outside of evidence. All the things that were argued by the prosecutor were certainly inferences based on the evidence admitted at trial. There was no invitation for the jury to put themselves in the subjective position of the victims, as was done in Kirkland. In short, this case has no similarity with Kirkland at all. This is a very straight, clean argument, both in the opening and the
closing.
Counsel,
so that I understand your answer to Justice Lansinger, though, if the excluded evidence were to be excluded, the questionable evidence, this is a strictly a circumstantial case. Is there any direct evidence?
No. And I think that was discussed at trial, and I think that was one of the main points the defense made in their presentation to the jury, was that there's no fingerprints at the scene, there's nothing per se at the scene that shows him, you know, videotaping him doing what he did. It is overwhelmingly a circumstantial case, but as this court is well aware, circumstantial evidence can be just as damning as direct evidence, and here it was quite damning. Unless this court has any specific questions on anything, I want to sum up by saying I think this is a record case, and I think it's one of the cleanest that has been tried, and I think the evidence is overwhelming.
Could you comment upon the penalty phase? I know we've been talking about the guilt phase here, but we look at both portions of the trial. And do you have anything to say about the penalty phase of the death sentence being imposed?
Yes, I think when this court reviews the mitigation phase, it will see that the defense presented a mitigation theory. It was that the defendant had a disadvantaged background. He was raised by a young mother who was disadvantaged and abused herself. It brought out that he has a work history. He got his GED outside of the justice system, which Judge Martin went out of his way to credit Pickens for, saying that this is something that he didn't see often, and it was to Pickens' credit that he did this. These were all mitigation factors that were argued and discussed in the mitigation phase. But at the end of the day, it was pitifully slight compared to the aggravating circumstances here. Two little children, the murder of Noelle Washington for just pursuing what her right is to do, which is a rape charge. It was a terrible case, Your Honors. Unless this court has anything else, I have nothing else to add to the brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, you've saved about a half a minute here.
Briefly, Judge, thank you, Your Honor. Really, basically, in the half minute that I have, that the weight of evidence is an issue here, and based on the stuff that, about the jailhouse witness and the witnesses that saw him, if you look at the cross-examination and of all of the people involved and the questions involved with these witnesses, we believe that not the weight of evidence is not in favor of the state of Ohio, if in fact the forfeiture by wrongdoing, all the evidence that came forth in that statement is eliminated. And again, Giles' decision just keeps talking and talking about having a fair trial, and we believe that there was no fair trial in this particular case by the input of the forfeiture by wrongdoing. That just as the prosecutor just said, Mr. Cummings, we had all this violent killing and stuff, and that's exactly what the issue was that we're arguing about, that the violent killing and plus this alleged raping situation and all the evidence that tied into the rape is the reason why he was convicted. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision.